When you think of historical weapons of mass persuasion, your mind probably goes straight to something, I don't know, something heavy.
Right, like a fiery table-pounding political speech or.
Yeah, or like a deeply poignant, gritty documentary.
Exactly, something that looks and sounds self-important. You know, something that demands you sit up straight and basically eat your intellectual vegetables.
Right. You almost never picture a weapon of mass persuasion covered in feathers, tack dancing its way towards you,
Yeah.
and belting out a catchy show tune.
No, you really don't. But sometimes, you know, when the cultural defenses are up, that is exactly what works best.
Which brings us to today. For this deep dive, we are pulling from a massive stack of source material, including a really comprehensive look into the history, the plot, and the sprawling global legacy of the groundbreaking 1983 musical La Cage aux Folles.
It is such a fascinating piece of theater history.
It really is. And our mission today is to figure out how a flashy, comedic musical about a French drag club managed to break down massive theatrical barriers, conquer the globe, and deliver this lasting message of acceptance during an era of really intense social anxiety. So you ready? Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah, so if we synthesize what this show actually is, we really have to look at its dual nature. Because on its surface, I mean, this musical is a pure, unadulterated farce.
Oh, absolutely.
It is feathers, it is sequins, it's people hiding in closets and mistaken identities. But underneath all of that, it secretly operates as a masterclass in empathy.
Wow, a master class.
Yeah, it basically used the bright lights of Broadway to sneak a deeply radical message right past the prejudices of a mainstream middle-class audience.
I just love that concept.
Yeah.
But, you know, to really grasp how this musical changed the culture, we first need to establish what the actual story is for you guys listening, and the inherently polarizing forces the writers pitted against each other at its core.
Let's lay out the narrative engine then. The plot is set in Saint-Tropez, France, and it centers entirely on a gay couple who have been together for over 20 years.
A long time.
Right. You have Georges, who is the suave master of ceremonies and the manager of the local drag nightclub, which is called La Cage aux Folles.
And then you have his romantic partner, Albin, who is the highly emotional star drag attraction of the club. He performs under the stage name Zaza.
Right. And they have built a very happy, very normal domestic life together. They live in an apartment right above the nightclub with their butler, Jacob.
Oh, Jacob is great.
He absolutely insists on being called the maid, and he desperately wants to be cast in the club's revue.
But then, of course, we get the inciting incident. Georges has a 24-year-old son named Jean-Michel.
Right, which surprises some people.
Yeah, he's the product of a brief, youthful, heterosexual fling Georges had in Paris with a woman named Sybil. But Jean-Michel was raised entirely by Georges and Albin. I mean, Albin essentially acted as his mother for his entire life.
And Jean-Michel comes home with huge news. He is engaged to a young woman named Anne.
Which sounds like a pretty standard setup, you know, until we meet Anne's parents.
This is where it gets good.
Right. Anne's father is a man named Edouard Dindon. And Edouard happens to be an ultra-conservative politician. Specifically, he is the deputy general of the Tradition, Family, and Morality Party.
And the stated political goal of his party is to literally shut down the local drag clubs to, quote, clean up the town.
Now, I want to pause here. To really understand the genius of this play, we have to look objectively at the two opposing sides the writers set up on stage. On one side, you have the flamboyant drag lifestyle of our protagonists, and on the exact opposite end, you have the strict tradition, family, and morality political platform. And I want to be super clear to you listening. We are absolutely not taking a side on the real-world politics of these stances.
No, not at all.
Our job here is just to look at the mechanics of the storytelling. But objectively, we can clearly see how putting these two diametrically opposed worldviews in a single room is just a recipe for absolute dramatic tension.
Exactly. Because the storytelling requires Anne's parents to come over and meet Jean-Michel's parents.
It is the ultimate meet the parents sitcom trope. I mean, we all know that setup,
Yeah,
right?
didn't I?
The quirky in-laws come over for dinner, the dog eats the roast, everything goes wrong. But the creators of this show supercharged the stakes. They didn't just give us quirky in-laws. They gave us an ultra-conservative politician who is actively trying to destroy the livelihood of the flamboyant drag queen he is about to sit down and have dinner with.
What's fascinating here is how that premise forces a collision of worlds. Because Jean-Michel is so panicked that he forces his father, Georges, to completely redecorate their apartment to hide their lifestyle.
Oh, it's so heartbreaking.
It is. He strips away anything provocative. And worse, he asks Albin, the man who literally raised him, to disappear for the night, and he invites his biological mother, Sybil, to play the role of the traditional wife instead.
It's basically an existential threat to George's and Albin's entire way of life.
Yeah.
And of course, because it's a farce, the biological mother, Sybil, doesn't show up.
Of course not.
So Albin has to step in. He throws on sensible shoes, a conservative dress, and pearls to play Jean-Michel's buxom 40-year-old mother.
Which naturally goes completely off the rails when they all end up at a local restaurant owned by their friend Jacqueline.
Right.
Jacqueline doesn't know about the ruse, so she asks Albin to sing a song. And Albin gets so caught up in the performance that he completely forgets he is supposed to be a conservative housewife and just tears off his wig right in front of the politician.
It's pure theatrical chaos. But the reason this specific culture clash was so volatile isn't just about the plot. It's about when this plot debuted on Broadway. We are talking about 1983.
Yes, the context is everything here, because this was the early years of the AIDS epidemic.
Right.
Homophobia in the broader culture was more intense and visible than ever before. So the creative team behind the scenes faced this profound tension about how to actually deliver a story centering a gay couple to a 1980s audience without completely alienating them.
And honestly, the behind-the-scenes drama was almost as wild as the musical itself. So the original producer, Alan Carr, who was the guy who produced the mega-hit movie Grease, by the way, he originally wanted to adapt the 1978 French film version of Le Cage.
Right.
But he couldn't secure the film rights. He had to settle for the rights to the original 1973 French played by Jean Poiret instead.
And that legal distinction ended up fundamentally shaping the narrative.
Wait, really? How?
Well, because they only had the playwrights, they actually couldn't use the character of the birth mother that was featured heavily in the film.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so they had to focus entirely on the core dynamic, the fact that George's and Albin's relationship is so deep and natural that the boy fully accepts a man as his mother.
Wow. But getting to that point was a massive mess. Because Carr originally hired an entirely different team to make an Americanized version set in New Orleans.
Right, which sounds so different.
Totally. But then the executive producers, Fritz Holt and Barry Brown, came in and immediately fired that entire creative team.
Just clean house.
Completely. It resulted in massive lawsuits. The original composer, Maury Yeston, actually won his lawsuit and ended up collecting a small royalty from Le Cage for years afterward.
So Holt and Brown have to start completely over. They bring in Arthur Laurence to direct, and Laurence is incredibly reluctant.
Why?
Well, he looked at the cultural climate in 1983 and thought they would never find enough investors to finance a gay-themed project. He literally only agreed to do it as a personal favor.
Wow. But then they bring in the heavy hitters. You have Harvey Fierstein writing the book.
Yeah.
And just to clarify for the listeners, the book of musical is the actual script, like the spoken dialogue and the overarching narrative between the songs.
Exactly.
So Fierstein is a very prominent vocal gay activist. Mm-hmm. You have Arthur Laurence directing, who is also highly political. Mm-hmm. But then you have Jerry Herman writing the music and lyrics.
And Jerry Herman was the fascinating moderating influence here.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
Well, Herman had suffered a series of flops with darker themed shows since 1969. So he looked at this project and said, I don't want a dark, gritty political piece. I want a massive, mainstream, optimistic hit.
He wanted a classic.
Exactly. He wanted an old-fashioned song and dance musical comedy that middle-class audiences would just eat up.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. And I have to push back a little here, or at least play devil's advocate.
Sure.
If you have Fierstein, who is a fiery activist wanting to make a loud statement in 1983, and Herman wanting to make a sweet, toe-tapping comedy.
Yeah.
Didn't that just result in Herman watering down the activism to make it palatable? Wasn't that essentially selling out the radical message?
It's a great question, but the source material actually argues the exact opposite.
Really?
Yeah. With Fierstein and Laurence at the helm, the show could have easily become a polemic diatribe on gay rights.
Right.
It could have been a lecture. But Herman's insistence on a sweetly entertaining manner was actually the ultimate strategic move. It was a Trojan horse. Think about the psychology. When you are laughing, when you are tapping your foot to a catchy, brassy melody, your defenses are down.
That makes total sense.
Point.
You aren't sitting there with your arms crossed.
Exactly. It allowed the central message that these two men love each other and their son deeply to slip right past the audience's prejudices with far more impact than a direct, aggressive lecture ever could.
I see. And the perfect example of this creative collaboration is the creation of the legendary act, one finale song, I Am What I Am.
Yes. Such an iconic moment.
Right. So according to Herman's version of the story, Fierstein showed up to Herman's Manhattan townhouse one day with this fiery, intensely emotional scene he had written for the exact moment Albin is cruelly rejected by his son. Mm-hmm. Fierstein had written the scene to end with the words, "I am what I am." Herman was so struck by the power of it, he asked to use those exact five words, boasted to Fierstein that he'd have a song by morning, and he actually did.
And that song became an absolute powerhouse. But here's the thing. Getting a song like that to land emotionally with an audience requires some very specific, highly engineered theatrical mechanics.
What do you mean?
Well, the theory of a sweetly entertaining musical comedy is brilliant, but you have to actually make the audience feel empathy for these characters in real time on a physical stage.
And they were terrified it wouldn't work.
They really were.
During the pre-Broadway tryout in Boston, they ran into a massive technical issue. The mechanized set completely failed before the second preview. And for you listening who don't know, a mechanized set means the scenery is built on tracks and motors to automatically slide in and out.
Right, it's very complex.
So when it breaks, the show basically grinds to a halt. The illusion dies. Jerry Herman actually had a massive panic attack when this happened. He was completely terrified that a conservative city like Boston was going to use the technical glitch as an excuse to flat-out reject a gay-themed musical.
But the crowd loved it. The heart of the story shone right through the broken set, yet the creators realized they had a much more subtle problem on their hands.
The touch issue.
Yes, the touch issue. They had written a profound love story where the two lovers barely touched each other on stage.
Right. Harvey Fierstein actually pointed this out during rehearsals. He suggested the characters needed to kiss on the cheeks at the end of the show to solidify the emotional stakes.
Mm-hmm.
Laurence, the director, agreed.
Yeah.
But he cleverly disguised it as a common French greeting, you know, men kissing each other on both cheeks. It was a brilliant loophole.
It really was.
It was a subtle way to show physical affection and intimacy without immediately triggering the biases of a 1980s audience.
It was all about careful, deliberate calibration. And you see this in the casting dynamics, too.
Oh, for sure.
George Hearn was playing Albin. Now, Albin is the showy, flashy drag role. The audience gets to literally watch this person put on makeup in the song A Little More Mascara.
Right.
They see the vulnerability and they see a marginalized person taking a stand for himself. Everyone, regardless of their background, can relate to that.
But on the flip side, you have Gene Barry, who was playing George's.
Yeah.
And Barry was really struggling to find his character.
He was having a tough time.
Yeah, during rehearsals, people even wanted to fire him. He was considered adequate, but he wasn't popping. You know, he was outstanding.
Until Arthur Laurence had a massive directorial breakthrough right before opening night.
This is my favorite part.
He gave Gene Barry a very specific, unbreakable stage direction. He told him, whenever you and George Hearn are on stage together, you must always look deeply into his eyes.
That is just incredible. It's like a magician's misdirection. You're sitting in the audience, completely distracted by Theoni V. Aldridge's glamorous, over-the-top drag costumes, while the director is quietly building a profound emotional anchor right in front of your eyes using nothing but silent acting choices.
Exactly.
Laurence also told Barry to introduce the nightclub acts with a massive flourish, treating the drag queens like grand opera singers. That gave Barry the grasp he needed on the character's pride, and he actually ended up getting a Tony nomination for it.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it demonstrates how small, highly intentional physical choices on a stage, like just holding unbroken eye contact, can completely override deep-seated audience biases.
Wow.
When two actors maintain that level of focus, the audience subconsciously stops seeing a controversial gay couple and just sees two human beings who have been deeply in love for 20 years. They sense the depth of the feeling before their conscious brains have a chance to reject it.
And that carefully engineered emotional anchor didn't just win over 1980s New York. It propelled the show into an absolute global phenomenon.
It did. The original Broadway production opened at the Palace Theater on August 21st, 1983. And it ran for four solid years. That is 1,761 performances.
You have to understand how massive this was, especially come award season. This show didn't just survive. It steamrolled the Tony Award.
Completely dominated.
It took home six of them, including Best Original Score, Best Book of a Musical, which again is the script, and the grand prize, Best Musical. And keep in mind, it beat out Stephen Sondheim's absolute masterpiece, Sunday in the Park with George, that year.
That is no small feat.
Not at all. George Hearn also took home Best Actor for playing Albin.
It helped make the 1983 season a historical landmark for Broadway. In fact, after Le Cage and Big River a bit later, a full decade would pass before another new American musical hit the 1,000 performance mark.
But its dominance didn't stop in the 80s. Le Cage became the very first musical in history to twice win the Tony Award for Best Revival of a Musical.
What?
First in 2005, with Gary Beach as Albin and Daniel Davis, and later the legendary Robert Goulet as Georges.
And then it won Best Revival again in 2010.
Right.
That 2010 production is a really vital case study, actually. It was a transfer from a highly scaled-down production at London's Menier Chocolate Factory.
Right. It starred Douglas Hodge as Albin, who won a Tony for it, by the way, and Kelsey Grammer as Georges.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, Harvey Fierstein himself actually stepped into the role of Albin on Broadway, which is amazing. Yeah. But what's so telling about this scaled-down version is that it proved the show didn't actually need the massive million-dollar mechanized spectacle to work.
Exactly.
When you stripped away the giant sets and the massive chorus, the heart of the story held up entirely on its own.
And that heart translates across cultures in a way no one could have predicted back in 1983.
I want you listening to think about this for a second. What stands out to you about a show dealing with hyper-specific French drag culture translating so seamlessly to a place like Estonia in 1999?
It's an incredible cultural leap, because that Estonian production was the very first time the show was staged anywhere in the former Soviet Union area.
Wow.
They had to translate the humor, the stakes, and the cultural nuances for an audience with completely different sociopolitical history.
Or what about Thailand in 2010? They didn't just translate the script, they adapted it entirely to fit their local audience.
Right.
They changed the character names, they changed the cultural references, and they set the story right there in Thailand.
We saw a similar adaptation in a 2009 Portuguese production, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They moved the entire location from Saint Tropez to the Portuguese coastal town of Cascais to make the setting relatable. They even added in other Jerry Herman songs like Tap Your Troubles Away to fit the new vibe.
That's so clever.
The source material lists productions all over. Sweden, Australia, Germany, Colombia, Mexico, Spain, South Korea, Panama, Puerto Rico, Hungary, the Philippines, Israel. The list of adaptations is just staggering.
And we absolutely cannot forget how the music itself crossed borders. That Act One finale, I Am What I Am, became a massive global hit all on its own when it was recorded by Gloria Gaynor.
Oh, absolutely.
It transcended the theater and became an absolute rallying cry for the global gay pride movement. Shirley Bassey recorded it. Tony Bennett recorded it.
This raises an important question, though. Why does a hyper-specific story about a drag club in Saint Tropez resonate so deeply with someone sitting in a theater in Bogota or Seoul or Budapest?
Yeah, why do you think that is?
The answer is that the core mechanisms of the story are universally human. It's about the definition of family. It's about personal identity.
Right.
It's about the lengths a parent will go to sacrifice for their child and the universal pain of a child being ashamed of who their parents are. Those emotions cut across every single cultural and linguistic boundary.
So what does this all mean for us today? We started this deep dive by looking at source material detailing a behind-the-scenes clash of creative visions.
Mm-hmm.
You had the fiery, urgent activism of Harvey Fierstein and Arthur Lawrence colliding head-on with the optimistic, mainstream sensibilities of Jerry Herman.
And the result of that collision was just a perfectly calibrated piece of art.
It really was.
They used humor, old-fashioned tap dancing, and deep, undeniable emotional heart to break down massive cultural barriers. The enduring legacy of La Cage aux Folles proves that when you want to change someone's mind or introduce a challenging idea to a potentially hostile audience, the most effective tool in your arsenal might not be a stern lecture.
Right.
Sometimes the absolute best tool for social change is just a shared laugh. It's giving the audience a relatable human connection, like watching two people hold eye contact that they can't help but feel in their chest.
I'm going to leave you with a final thought to mull over, and it ties right back into the climax of the show.
Oh, the escape scene.
Yes. At the end of Act Two, the paparazzi have swarmed the nightclub. They were waiting outside to photograph the anti-homosexual activist Edward Dindon inside the notorious drag venue, which would completely ruin his political career.
Right, he's trapped.
Exactly. So to get the conservative parents out safely so his son can finally get married, Georges makes a deal. He sneaks the Dindons out of the club by dressing them up in full drag, disguised as members of the nightclub's revue.
It is the ultimate theatrical escape plan.
It really is. Think about the layers of that grand finale. The rigid, ultra-conservative antagonists are forced to literally put on the sequins, don the wigs, and walk in the exact shoes of the marginalized people they had dedicated their lives to shutting down just to survive the night.
It is an incredibly powerful, subversive image.
It makes you wonder, in our own modern culture wars, what would happen if we forced our loudest critics to literally wear the uniform of the people they are trying to silence?
It definitely changes your perspective.
It brings us right back to where we started. The most effective weapon of mass persuasion wasn't a debate, and it wasn't a diatribe. It was a comedy covered in feathers. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep asking questions, keep looking past the surface, and we'll catch you next time.